Chapter 2. To whom did God give the law? With regard to the law, Paul divides the human race into two. All are sinners, but some have sinned without law, the rest have sinned in the law, Romans 2:12. This is the biblical divide, those under the law and those without law, 1 Corinthians 9:20-21. Those in the law have the law of God, those without law do not. Truly, therefore, the law could not have been given to all men. If it had, Paul's division would have been utterly meaningless, indeed nonsensical. Those in or under the law are the Jews, God having made known his entire law to Israel. Those without law are, therefore, non-Jews, Gentiles. We are specifically and repeatedly told that God did not reveal his law to any other nation but Israel. He did not deal in this way with any other people. The principle underlies Romans 9:30-32. We are told expressly that the Gentiles do not have the law, Romans 2:12-14, but that it was given to the Jews, being the statutes and judgments and laws which the Lord made between himself and the children of Israel on Mount Sinai by the hand of Moses, Leviticus 26:46. God immediately reiterating the point with the closing verse of Leviticus. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded for the children of Israel on Mount Sinai. Leviticus 27:34. Right from the start, while the people were camped in the wilderness of Sinai, even as Moses was called up to the mountain to receive the law, God prefaced it all, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel." God opened the Ten Commandments thus, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And after the re-giving of the law, God could declare to Moses, "According to the tenor of these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel." Nor was it the last time Israel was reminded of the fact. Solomon called Israel to take care to fulfill the statutes and judgments with which the Lord charged Moses concerning Israel. When Israel was removed from the land and taken into captivity, the king of Assyria replaced the children of Israel in Samaria with foreigners. These foreigners, it's recorded, brought their own gods and their own rituals. Rejecting the law of the Hebrews, they did not follow their statutes or their ordinances, or the law and commandments which the Lord had commanded the children of Jacob, whom he named Israel. Addressing Israel, God could speak of the statutes, the ordinances, the law, and the commandments which he wrote for you, promising Israel they would not wander any more from the land which I gave their fathers, but only if they are careful to do according to all that I have commanded them, and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. As with the land, so with the law, both have been given to Israel, and to no others. When God revealed his law to Israel, he expressly commanded them not to do as the pagans did, but to observe my judgments and keep my ordinances, to keep my statutes and my judgments. Centuries after Sinai, God had to complain that Israel had not done this. "You have not walked in my statutes, nor executed my judgments, but have done according to the customs of the Gentiles, which are all around you." They had conformed to the standards of the nations around them, breaking God's law. This makes sense if, and only if, God's and Israel's laws were different to the laws, principles, statutes, norms, judgments, and standards of the pagans. Asaph reminded Israel that the Lord established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers. Daniel, when praying for the children of Israel, could speak of God's laws, which he set before us by his servants the prophets. God reminded Hosea concerning Israel, "I have written for him the great things of my law." And God, the one of Sinai, God, the God of Israel, commanded Israel to remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel, with the statutes and judgments. In Numbers 15, God said the law applied to the Jews, and those who would be reckoned Jews, proselytes, and sojourners. To say that the law applies to the entire human race is to render these statements and demands utterly superfluous and meaningless. What is more, and a glance at the passages quoted above will confirm it, we're talking about the law of God, the law of Moses, the whole law, the law in its entirety. The law was given to Israel, for Israel, to distinguish Israel from all others. Nor was this a mere quirk of history. As I've noted, God treated the Jews as special, showing special regard for them in giving them his law. This was his purpose. He gave his law to the Jews in order to distinguish them from all others. Division was God's intention in giving the law to the Jews. Division, separation, distinction was God's great concern for Israel. And it was the law that especially marked the Jews out from the Gentiles, serving as a dividing wall, a partition, a demarcation between them and the pagans, Galatians and Ephesians. The law regulated their national and personal life in every respect. Finally, it was a temporary measure, confining Israel, until the coming of Christ, Galatians 3:19-24. Moses, when repeating God's law in Moab, made it plain to whom it was given, declaring, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. He said, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." God said, "Israel," and he meant Israel, and only Israel. It was only Israel whom he had delivered from Egypt. But not only was the preface to the Ten Commandments peculiar to Israel, the fourth commandment concerned the Sabbath, which was a special sign for Israel, Exodus 31, Ezekiel 20, and the fifth commandment referred to the land promised to Israel. In addition, the overwhelming bulk of the hundreds of other commandments contained in the law were spelled out in terms which belonged only to Israel. In short, Gentiles were not brought out of Egypt. In fact, many of them, that is the Egyptians, perished in Egypt or the Red Sea. Gentiles were not given the Sabbath as a special sign that they were the people of God. Gentiles were not given the pillar of cloud and fire. Gentiles were not given the manna. Gentiles were not given the promised land. The truth is, they had to be removed from it. Gentiles were not given the ordinances of the tabernacle. And so on. As just one example of how these things are linked, take Nehemiah 9:5-15. Sadly, all this has too often been forgotten, and the law which was given uniquely to Israel and applied only to them has been mistakenly applied to Gentiles in the gospel age, to the confusion of both law and gospel. What is more, not only did God at Sinai give his law to Israel and only to Israel, but prior to Sinai, nobody had the law, not even the patriarchs. Notice how explicit Moses was at the repetition of the law in Moab, when reminding the Israelites of the first giving and its re-giving of the law at Horeb or Sinai. God did not make the covenant with our fathers, but with us. Who were these fathers, and who were the us? The fathers were the patriarchs, and their descendants who had died before the giving of the law at Sinai. God did not give his law to them. The us were the Israelites, the people with their children who, having been delivered from Egypt, were gathered as the nation of Israel at Sinai. It was to them that God originally gave the law, and it was to their children that he was now renewing it in Moab. That generation of Hebrews at Sinai, therefore, was the first to receive the law, the patriarchs, the fathers, who lived before the children of Jacob even entered Egypt, let alone left it, did not have the law. The song of Moses, when he blessed the children of Israel before his death, is plain. The Lord came from Sinai, and dawned on them from Seir. From his right hand came a fiery law for them. God commanded a law for us, a heritage of the congregation of Jacob. Levi shall teach Jacob your judgments, and Israel your law. That nobody had the law before Sinai is clear, since Paul expressly pointed out that the law came, was added, 430 years after God's covenant with Abraham, Galatians 3. It was revealed at Sinai. It wasn't renewed. How can it be claimed that God gave the law to Adam at creation or to the patriarch? Yet many do say it. No. As Christ said, when replying to the Pharisees' question over the divorce certificate regulation introduced by Moses, from the beginning, that is Adam, it was not so. The law was given to Moses 430 years after the promise to Abraham, not given to Adam hundreds of years before Abraham. In stressing this, I am not straining out arithmetical or historical maps. To say that Adam was given the Mosaic law is to miss a point of major consequence, contradicting Paul's argument in Romans 5 and Galatians 3, to which I shall return. The law was given to Moses long after God had revealed his saving purpose in and to Abraham. This is a point of such importance, I must take a few moments to explain what I'm talking about. The eschatological importance of the epoch of the law. This point, the place of the law in salvation history, the eschatological importance of the epoch of the law, cannot be overstressed. This word eschatological will come again and again in these pages. Let me explain how I'm using it. I am thinking of the way in which God, in time, works out his eternal decree to save his elect, and thus exalt his Son in their final glorification. I have in mind the way God arranges everything to bring about his purpose, the place every last thing has in that great plan. Salvation history is one of the great themes, the greatest theme of the Bible. It permeates Romans 3-11 and Galatians 3-4, for example. So what is this salvation history that I'm talking about? The salvation aspect is God's redemption of his elect, culminating in their eternal glorification in the image of Christ. And what of the history? This needs nuancing. God decreed the redemption of his elect. The purpose, means, and ends of their redemption in eternity. But he is accomplishing it in time as a part of history. Adam, the promise to Abraham, the law at Sinai, the coming life, death, resurrection, and ascension of Christ, Pentecost, the return of Christ, and so on, are milestones in this historical process, which is divided into two great ages, two great eras, two great dispensations or epochs. Before Christ, and after Christ. Everything centers on Christ and his work. He, in his death, burial, and resurrection, is the watershed of the two ages, the climax of all history, including, and especially, salvation history. The two ages in question are very different. Adam is the head, the founder of one age, Christ of the other, Romans 5. Adam's age is characterized by flesh, sin, law, and death. Christ's age is characterized by the Spirit, righteousness, grace, and life. All humanity is by birth united to Adam and comes under the regime of the first age through Adam's sin. All the elect are united to Christ from eternity by God's decree, in experience through faith in Christ, and come under the regime of the new age in, by, and through Christ's death, burial, and resurrection. It is at this point that the time element of the word history needs nuancing. The truth is, the two ages are running alongside each other, and have done so since the beginning of salvation history. It is not that Adam's age lasted until Christ's resurrection. Adam's age is still with us. That is why I am using the present tense. Adam's age is characterized by flesh, sin, and law. All humanity is, by birth, united to Adam, and comes under the regime of the first age through Adam's sin. Is, not was. So when I speak about salvation history, I am thinking of two ages, yes, but not merely in the sense of time. Rather, I am thinking more particularly in terms of their characteristics. I am thinking of two realms, two regimes. The old Adamic age or realm is the age or realm of the flesh, sin, law, and death. The new Christian age or realm is the age or realm of the Spirit, righteousness, grace, and life. The work of Christ took place in time, in history, and was the historical breakpoint or watershed for these two ages or realms, certainly. But for any particular individual, the transformation comes at the point of saving faith. Conversion brings a change of regime, a change of age, a change of covenant. If anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things have passed away. Behold, all things have become new. Speaking to believers, Paul could declare, "The Father has delivered us from the power of darkness and conveyed or transferred us into the kingdom of the Son of his love." Peter, you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And when and what will be the culmination of salvation history? That too centers on Christ. The culmination will be when Christ delivers the kingdom to God the Father, that God may be all in all. So, when I talk of the eschatological significance of the epoch of the law in salvation history, I mean the status of the law in this scheme of salvation, how it fits into God's accomplishment of salvation, that is, its place, both in time and characteristics. The law was given at a particular time, and lasted for a limited time, and for a specified purpose. What was its role? What is its role today? In other words, I am speaking about the law in two senses, historical and experiential. Historical for humanity, experiential for the individual. Having explained what I mean by the place of the law in salvation history, let me take up my main theme once again. The law, the whole law, was given to the Jews, for the Jews at Sinai. How fitting, therefore, for Paul to call it our Father's law, the law of the Jews. When addressing Felix, Paul could easily link his worship of the God of my fathers with the law and the prophets. How apt, therefore, was his reminder to the Jews, as distinct from the Gentiles, that they had the law. How pointless, if all men. Think of the way in which Paul preached to the Gentiles. Think of his experience at Lystra. The Gentiles were about to worship him and Barnabas. How did the brothers stop the pagans? What arguments did they use? Did they cite the first and second commandments? They didn't. Instead, from nature, they challenged pagan folly in trying to worship them. In effect, they asked, "Does not nature teach you?" If the Gentiles had been given the law, why did Paul not quote it against them? The fact is, since the Gentiles didn't have the law, Paul could not use it in his approach to them, and he made no attempt to do so. The same goes for his preaching to the Athenians in the Areopagus. Paul used what the pagans were familiar with. Compare this approach with Christ addressing the rich young Jew. Think of Peter preaching to Jews in proselytes. He was able to quote freely from the Old Testament. Again, when preaching to Jews in the temple, he referred to Moses and all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken. In particular, he pointed them to the covenant which God made with our fathers, and later quoted the Psalms. Think of Stephen's approach when he was preaching to the Jews. "You who have received the law," he said. Likewise, Paul used the law when preaching to the Jews, as in his defense against the Jews, speaking of our people and the customs of our fathers. But never once did he use the law when addressing Gentile unbelievers. Why not? Because he only used the law when he could say, "I speak to those who know them." None of this was an accident. The preachers of the New Testament knew where their unconverted hearers were coming from. They knew that the Jews had the law, and therefore the gospel preachers were able to use it. The Gentiles did not have the law, so they did not refer them to it. In this they were following Amos, who, addressing the nations Damascus, Gaza, Tyre, Edom, Ammon, Moab, Judah, and Israel, reprove them for their sins. Not once did the prophet mention the law when speaking to pagans, but on turning to Judah, he immediately complained that they have despised the law of the Lord and have not kept his commandments. The overtones of Jane's statement in Acts 15 are unmistakable. Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Synagogues and Sabbath are not Gentile terms. Years later, when Paul arrived at Jerusalem, James told him about the believing Jews in Jerusalem, who have been informed about you, that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses. Paul didn't deny it. The implication is clear. The Jews were under Moses. The Gentiles were not. Note further the contrast between Paul's action as a Jew and the requirements laid upon Gentiles, as recorded in Acts 21:21-25. As the apostle explained, "To the Jews I became as a Jew, to those under the law as under the law, to those who are without law as without law." Why? "In order to win the more, I do this for the gospel's sake." 1 Corinthians 9. Acts 2, verse 23, is very interesting in this connection. Peter, preaching Christ, told the Jewish crowd on the day of Pentecost, "You have taken him by lawless hands, have crucified him, and put him to death." The Jews were responsible for crucifying Christ. But to do the dirty work, they used Roman hands, Gentile hands, lawless hands. The New American Standard, translating the phrase, "by the hands of godless men," has a marginal note. Lawless hands, or men without the law, that is, heathen. The NIV correctly notes, "of those not having the law, that is, Gentiles." Christ had already foretold this is what would happen. The Son of Man will be delivered to the Gentiles, and will be mocked and insulted and spit upon. They will scourge him and kill him. Peter, steeped in Jewish thought, was using the phrase lawless men in the Jewish sense. The men he was talking about were men without the law. That is to say, they were lawless, outside the law of God, Gentiles. The Jews boasted of their having of the law. They were the only people to have it. All the rest were lawless. So as Peter said, Christ was crucified by the Jews who had the law, making use of the Gentiles who did not have the law. The without the law people, to do the work. See also Matthew 20:18-19, and Galatians 2:15, where Jews by nature are contrasted with sinners of the Gentiles, or Gentile sinners. Sinners and Gentiles in such a context means those who are lawless, lawless, outside the law, beyond the pale. When the Jews wanted Christ put to death, they could tell Pilate, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die." But the Roman governor had already told them, "You take him, and judge him according to your law." When the Jews of Corinth brought Paul to court before Gallio, accusing him of persuading men to worship God contrary to the law, Gallio refused to entertain the case, on the grounds that it was none of his business. He roundly told them he wouldn't get involved in a question of words and names and your own law. Your own law, I emphasize, with a dismissive, "Look to it to yourselves, for I don't want to be a judge of such matters." He cleared the court. Claudius Lysias spoke in a similar way when writing to Felix, calling the accusation laid against Paul by the Jews questions of their law. No concern of his. Something outside his jurisdiction, comprehension and competence. The Jews confirmed this by telling Felix they had wanted to judge Paul according to our law. Festus was in the same quandary as Felix. While he was familiar with the custom of the Romans, he was uncertain of such questions as he was now being asked, questions about their own religion. Paul, standing before Agrippa, was happy to think his judge was an expert in all customs and questions which have to do with the Jews, including the words of the prophets. Our religion, he called it, with the clear implication that Gentiles, generally speaking, had at best only a limited knowledge of God's revelation to the Jews and their customs, religion, and law. All this is strange, to put it mildly. If these Gentiles had been as much under the law as the Jews, I realize these Gentiles were politicians as well as magistrates, soldiers or kings, and I wouldn't treat their words as the final authority on biblical principles, but they do nothing to contradict the claim that the law was given only to the Jews. And what of Hebrews 7:11? We are told that under the law, and what of Hebrews 7:11? We are told that under the Levitical priesthood, the people received the law. Well, it's not easy to determine precisely what the writer meant. At the very least, we may speak of a link between the Levitical priesthood, the Israelites, and the law. In fact, it's much stronger than this. It was under the Levitical priesthood that Israel received the law. The NIV, a New American Standard, used the word basis. Israel received the law on the basis of the Levitical priesthood. Now, who received the Levitical priesthood? The Jews. The Jews and no others. No Gentiles had the Levitical priesthood. Consequently, only the Jews could have received the law, since no people could have the law without the Levitical priesthood and vice versa. The two were inextricably linked. Hebrews 7 throughout. The two stood or fell together. The priesthood being changed, of necessity there is also a change of the law. Under this system, unique to the Jews, the law required Levi to collect the tithe from his brothers, not all men, and so on. Therefore, of all nations, Israel alone received the law. But what about Romans 3, verse 19? The verse reads, "Now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God." Surely this teaches that all men, Jews and Gentiles, are under the law. But no, it does not, even though at first glance it seems like it. As I've shown, the context proves that the law here includes at least the Ten Commandments, but more. It is the Old Testament as a whole. It is the law. The law in its entirety. Furthermore, note how Paul said that the law speaks to those who were under it. This ought to give pause for thought. If all men are under the law, then Paul wrote what amounts to a truism. The fact that he made such an observation at all. The law speaks to those who are under it, indicates there is something to be taken notice of. To whom was he referring? Who were those who were under the law? Those to whom the law speaks. The context from Romans 2:1 and on is conclusive. He was clearly referring to the Jews. They were under it. It was given to them. The law certainly stopped their mouths. They had the law. They were under it. But since they failed to keep it, it condemned them. It took away all their excuse. Pharisees might think that knowing the law, having the law, was all that counted. But far from being justified by possession of the law, they would be judged by the law. For, as the apostle explained, not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified. But while the Gentiles in Romans 3, verse 9. The words, "to those who are under the law," imply that there are others who are not under the law. The Gentiles, Paul explained, did not have the Jews' advantage. They were not given the law. They were not under it, Romans 2, 12-15. Even so, some of them at least were living up to the light they had, and by nature do the things in the law, who show the work of the law written in their hearts, and in this respect did better than the Jews. This does not mean that some Gentiles, by their works, were free of sin and so avoided God's wrath. No, the point is, God is impartial. The Jews who had the law will be judged, and the Gentiles who did not have the law will also be judged, and both will be judged fairly by God, Romans 1:18 to 3:20. What is more, if the Gentiles, who never had the advantage of receiving the law, were unable to voice any excuse for their sin, how much more guilty were the Jews who had the law and boasted about it? The Jews had the light of God's word. The Gentiles did not. But even so, all sinned and were guilty before God. The Jews against the law, and the Gentiles against some sort of moral consciousness. And both were responsible. The principle is clear. More light, more responsibility. This is Paul's argument. Whether or not men had the law, Paul had already charged both Jews and Greeks that they are all under sin. As he said, quoting and citing the Old Testament, the law, "There is none righteous, no, not one, none, 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 for there is no difference, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. And as with sin, so with salvation. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile. God is impartial between them. In short, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. The Jews who had the law were silenced by it. The Gentiles who did not have the law had no excuse in any case. Hence, all the world is guilty before God. God has bound all men over to disobedience. The Scripture has confined all under sin, all men, all things, the creation, the whole creation. In short, both Jews and Greeks are all under sin, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. In other words, Romans 3:19 supports the claim that the law was given to the Jews and not to the Gentiles. Many Reformed teachers will have none of it. The law was given to all men in Adam, they say. It was reinstated to all men through Moses, and all men are under the law today. Some go further. Men will be under it in eternity. These statements are wrong on several counts. Although it is claimed that men know the law of God by nature, and have done so from Adam, it is significant that such teachers never include the Sabbath in trying to justify their claim. Let's think about this for a minute. Are we really to believe that pagans know they must rest from Friday sunset to Saturday sunset? Can anybody tell us of a pagan people, completely without Scripture, which keeps the Sabbath or feels guilty for not keeping it? Can anyone point to any man, including the patriarch, before Exodus 16, who kept the Sabbath? Furthermore, the notion that the moral law was reinstituted, or reinstated, or restated on Sinai, because it had fallen into obscurity, is without a shred of evidence. Romans 5:20 disproves it. The law, the whole law, entered at Sinai. It was not restated, because it had fallen into obscurity. It entered the world at that time. More of this anon, much more. But the simple point I wish to make in this chapter is that the law was given to the Jews at Sinai. It was not given to the Gentiles, either at Sinai or at creation. It was not given to the Gentiles, full stop. But what are those places in the New Testament where Paul addresses believers as those no longer under the law? Since he must have been including Gentiles in at least some of the passages, does this not mean that the Gentiles were under the law, after all? The answer is no. As I come to the passages, I will deal with the question in detail, but for now I simply state that on several occasions Paul was speaking either of his own personal experience as a Jew, or else he was speaking of the Jews and not Gentiles. And even when he was clearly addressing Gentiles, he was often rebuking them for seeking to go under the law, allowing themselves to be put under it by false teachers, Judaizers, or going back to the slavery of pagan principles, this last having nothing to do with the law of Moses at all. Christ has redeemed his people from all bondage. Even so, there are some passages where such explanations still do not satisfy. Romans 2:14-15 is the explanation of all such. I now turn to these very important verses.